This meeting of the House Transportation Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. on Thursday, May 1st. Happy May Day. It's 2025 in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative McCabe, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, Co-Chair Carrick, and myself, Co-Chair Eichheit. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Representative Tilton has just joined us. Thank you. Before we begin, I would like to thank Suniva St. Clair from House Records, as well as Susan Quigley from Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Our committee aides are Meredith Trainer and staffer Griffin Sukale. Thank you for all being here. Your work makes our meeting possible. On today's agenda, we have consideration of amendments to House Bill 186, Apprentice Labor in Public Projects, followed by a rescheduled presentation on the Metropolitan Planning Organization boundary process. And we'll wrap up with testimony from Fast Planning Policy Board member and Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly member Scott Crass, as well as a brief question and answer discussion with other MPO staff and board members online. Co-Chair Carrick, before we get started, would you like to briefly speak to your bill before we take up House Amendments, House Bill 186?
Thank you, Co-Chair Aisha. Just as a very brief reintroduction, House Bill 186 is twofold. One, it has a requirement that insofar as is practicable, which is the operable word in the legislation, that apprentice labor will be utilized for a percentage of public labor projects over a threshold currently of $2.5 million. The second purpose of House Bill 186 is data gathering on apprenticeship utilization in Alaska. And that's the brief reintroduction.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. We have two amendments for consideration today. Representative McCabe, would you like to make a motion to move your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment 1.
We have an objection. Representative McCabe, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some background here. Amendment 1 addresses Alaska's Little Davis-Bacon Act, which is unfounded under AS Title 36, which requires contractors on public construction projects over $25,000 to pay prevailing wages. That threshold was last updated in 2011. Since then, construction costs have increased 90 to 110%. A project that cost $25,000 in 2011 would now cost closer to $50,000, excluding Alaska's higher transportation and logistical expenses. Other states have raised or eliminated their threshold, some as high as $500,000 to $1 million, to reflect inflation and support local contractor participation. So I would urge support as this amendment raises the Little Davis-Bacon threshold from $25,000 to $150,000. It reflects real inflation. It accounts for Alaska's unique geography. Unlike most states, many Alaskan communities are only accessible by air or barge, driving up costs even for very small projects. The $25,000 threshold is unworkable in rural areas. In our villages and smaller cities that are off the road system or far from bigger cities that have union populations and have bigger contractor populations are screaming for relief. This also reduces regulatory burdens on small projects. LDBA compliance imposes significant administrative and reporting requirements. For small contract, these burdens outweigh the benefits of prevailing wage enforcement, discouraging local contracts, and increasing project costs. One of which, by the way, is the engineering costs. So over $25,000 projects right now not only need LDBA wages, but they also need to be engineered. So if you want to put down a mile of gravel 4 inches thick, it's going to cost $30,000 to $40,000 with the trucks. Now you have to have it engineered because it's over $25,000. That's a minimum of $70,000. So your $25,000 or $30,000 project is now $100,000. You can see how this affects small villages such as Nenana or Yuzinki or Port Lyons or some of those places that are off the road system. So this supports local economic development. Raising the threshold makes it feasible for small and rural contractors to bid on public projects, creating jobs and building local capacity, particularly in these underserved regions. It still maintains the integrity of LDBA. The amendment preserves prevailing wage protections for medium and large-scale projects where one would think the unions would be most interested in, including those under HB 186, where compliance is cost-effective and enforcement is impactful. Amendment 1 supports HB 186's mandate of 15% apprentice labor on projects over $2.5 million, and I'm aware that there is another amendment to raise that. But it eases LDBA burdens on smaller contracts, which encourages small and rural contractors who often train apprentices to participate in public projects, expanding the apprentice pipeline. That's why I asked in one of the first hearings on 186 if you could accrue your time for apprenticeship in a non-union company. Very important. There are some contractors that might have one or two employees, and they have a dump truck or two and maybe a dozer, and it's an important aspect of our economy, I think, to encourage this pipeline for apprentices as well as smaller contractors. This targeted, reasonable update reflects economic realities, promotes rural participation, and ensures public dollars are spent efficiently, especially the smaller village and city dollars. Raising the LDBA threshold to $150,000 modernizes the statute without undermining its core purpose while strengthening HB 186's goal of building a skilled workforce. So I would ask your adoption of this amendment, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. I'd like to give Representative Carrick a chance to speak on the amendment next, but I just a little housekeeping thing. I did not hear who made the objection. I know it was on my right. So, Representative Carrick, Co-Chair Carrick, would you like to speak on this Amendment 1?
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Ash. I respectfully oppose Amendment Number 1. The legislation before you is about apprenticeship utilization in public projects, and Little Davis-Bacon wages are not the subject of this bill. I think there's probably a merited argument to readdress Little Davis-Bacon wages and the thresholds there to adjust to inflation, but it's really not within the scope of this bill, and I'd probably like to see this in a different piece of legislation, and I think we have seen it in other legislation before as well. So that's, I guess, the main thrust of my opposition. And in addition, I hear some of the arguments related to rural projects, but I am very hesitant to adjust Little Davis-Bacon wage thresholds without a lot more context and information. So that's kind of the crux of my opposition.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Just for the record, Representative Moore showed up or joined us.
Wow.
I'm sorry. My apologies. Representative Moore joined us at 1:11 p.m., and we are on Amendment 1 to House Bill 186. Representative Moore, my apologies. Other discussion on Amendment Number 1 from Representative McCabe. Representative McCabe.
So if you don't mind if I respond to that last comment, Co-Chair Eichheit, I appreciate it. So this is exactly where this amendment belongs. Apprenticeship, by definition, is a union function. Nobody else really deals with apprenticeships or journeymen or masters. That comes with the union, frankly, and I can think of no better place to put this to encourage apprenticeship, especially in smaller communities. Can you imagine a place off the road system somewhere? How would a person that wants to be an apprentice be able to build up his skills? So he may go to school. He comes back to his village after school or after tech school or CTE, and he's there for the summer. He might be there for a year, and he wants to build up his hours for apprenticeship, and he can't do it because there's no contractors there. And why is there no contractors there? Because they can't afford this threshold to do the projects that they want to do in their community. So this makes sense, and I can't begin, and it was a bill last year, but I can't begin to tell you the number of small communities that called me and talked to me and said, We are in desperate need of this because we must have a way to get these smaller projects done without having to import union labor from the big cities. So I think this is exactly where this belongs. And frankly, Ledge Legal does too. So.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Further discussion on Amendment 1? Representative Stutes?
Thank you. I'm just a little, doggone it, I just don't know enough about it. I understand what you're saying, and I know where my, with the small communities that I have around the island, I just wish we had had a little more conversation on this, doggone it. Thank you.
Further discussion on Amendment 1? See none. Representative Carrick, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay. So with that, I would ask the clerk to call the roll for Amendment 1.
Representative Tilton.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Stutes.
No.
Representative Mina.
No.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Co-Chair Eichein.
No.
Co-Chair Carrick?
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
So with a vote of 3 yeas and 4 nays, Amendment 1 fails. Thank you, Representative McCabe, for the amendment. Next is Amendment 2, I believe, by Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move Amendment number 2.
Object.
We have an objection to Amendment 2 by Representative McCabe. Representative Stutes, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Mr. Co-Chair, I would prefer that the other co-chair, Representative Carrick, speak to it.
Yes. Co-Chair Carrick?
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. I'm grateful that Representative Stutes agrees to offer this Amendment number 2. Basically, Amendment number 2 just increases the current contract threshold of $2.5 million to $5 million. So this will decrease the number of projects that require trying to, insofar as is practicable, achieve that 15% of apprentice labor hours. And this amendment is being offered pursuant to the committee discussion we've had on this legislation related to the potential burden on contractors and the Department of Transportation to try and meet the requirements to both find and then catalog apprenticeship utilization. So the idea is by increasing the threshold to $5 million, we're excluding some of the smaller projects that are out there. And as was discussed in our previous hearing on this bill, with inflation, there $2.5 million is somewhat of a low threshold. The previous administrative order had it at that threshold, but $5 million may capture somewhat fewer projects while still getting to kind of the meat of projects that are out there on the table in Alaska right now. I look forward to committee discussion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Further discussion on Amendment 2? Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So, yeah, it's interesting. Now we're shrinking the number of projects, and with the demise of Amendment 1, we have also shrunk it on the other end. So now we are really limiting the amount of projects where apprentices could be or would be required to be used. So it frustrates me that I'm in full agreement with the $5 million. I would like to see it go higher because I think that we need to be about the middle of the pack. But I'm not going to vote for this because we have shrunk the ability to use apprentices and the requirement to use apprentices on the bottom end of this. So that's my statement, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Stutes?
Thank you. I want to be clear in my own mind that there's not a requirement to use these apprentices. Is that correct? It's when it's practicable, but it doesn't stop any kind of construction or any kind of project from moving forward if you don't have these apprentices. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, but I defer to Co-Chair Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Representative Stutes. That is correct. So it's insofar as is practicable. However, the and that would be true at $2.5 million as the threshold, or $5 million. But at $5 million, we are also in this legislation putting in place some reporting requirements for apprenticeship utilization. And so the idea is we'd just have fewer projects that are trying to find, to the extent practicable, those 15% labor requirements. So, you know, the legislation intent would remain the same with a higher threshold, but in either case, it's not a requirement to get 15%. It is a goal to get 15% of apprenticeship labor.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And speaking from a former union negotiator, as much as practicable is undefined, and it leaves a door wide open for the unions to say you must have 15%. So legal will tell you that that term is not defined enough to actually be in this statute, really. And I would tell you from experience that it leaves the door wide open, as the unions will absolutely say you must have 15% on there, regardless of whether you have to pay him to sit in a lawn chair with an umbrella over his head and do nothing. You must have 15%.
Further discussion on Amendment 2? Then I'll just add, I appreciate this amendment. It came from that discussion that we had in terms of negotiation. The great thing about negotiation is there's two sides, and it's an iterative process and never a slam dunk. The way I understood this was a target, I like that first step. But I really like this amendment and how it is responsive to the discussion we had previously. See no further mics up. Representative McCabe, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay. Would the clerk please call the roll on Amendment 2?
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative Stutes.
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Tilton.
No.
Co-chair Carrick.
Yes.
Co-chair Eichheid.
Yes.
Four yeas, three nays.
With a vote of four yeas and three nays, Amendment 2 to House Bill 186 has been adopted. With no further amendments, I would accept a motion to move House Bill 186 out of committee.
Mr. Co-chair, I move House Bill 186, Apprentice Labor in Public Projects, Work Order 34-LS0816/A, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative McCabe, would you like to speak to your objection? Any further discussion?
I have something.
Co-chair Carey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheid. Just because we are about to take a vote on the legislation moving from committee, I just wanted to note that I recognize the concerns of Representative McCabe related to the potential of apprentices being potentially unable to perform certain job tasks, but I just would like to correct some of the statements that we have apprentices on a regular basis sitting in lawn chairs drinking Mai Tais with an umbrella over their head. That is just not the case in the workforce today. And our apprenticeship labor is the workforce of our future. We need these people to stay in Alaska, to be employed on projects in Alaska. We need them in our workforce. And a lot of these folks are young people with families that are going to be raised in Alaska. We have seen so much loss of federal funding opportunity in our state this year, and we are going to lose apprentices. So this legislation is just one piece of an overall workforce development goal that I have, to get more people into trades, employed working in those trades, and then ultimately becoming journeymen and working long into the future. So I recognize where the concern is coming from with the comment, but I just wanted to also say, in support of our apprentices, that many of them are doing the absolute best work that they can, and a lot of them end up becoming the plumbers, pipe fitters, roofers, welders, electricians that we need long into the future. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stutes.
I might be a little behind the curve in asking this question, if I might, Mr. Co-Chair. In your investigation and doing your homework on this bill, so to speak, did you have any conversations in relation to the Davis-Bacon wages and it causing any difficulties or preventing smaller communities from getting the apprenticeships as Representative McCabe suggested?
Through the co-chair to Representative Stutes, no, but I have had those kinds of conversations in the past as a member of also the Labor and Commerce Committee. The legislation that was brought forward today as an amendment was discussed, and the concept has been discussed before. You know, this legislation before you, unlike the amendment that was offered today, is aspirational rather than, you know, offering strict requirements. And so the amendment that was offered today would offer, you know, a higher threshold that would be a strict requirement. This legislation is pursuant to an old administrative order that offers a goal for a threshold. If it's not able to be met, then it's not able to be met. But it forces our contractors and both public and private apprentices to be utilized on projects up to that percentage insofar as it's available. And so I would just note that. And in other words, the issues discussed have been discussed, but not necessarily as a part of this bill.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so the problem I have with what you said is there is no pipeline into the apprenticeship program right now. And there, that's the reason there are limited or small number of apprentices to choose from. There, I've had discussions with contractors recently and with the DOT recently where a contractor went to look for apprentices and there were two, and they might have needed 10. So there's no pipeline to get people from these lower-paying jobs into the apprenticeship program where they are paid a percentage of Little Davis-Bacon wages and all the way on up to the major contractors that employ union labor. So if it were me and I was the head of a union, I would welcome the increase and the increase in smaller contractors because it provides a pipeline for an 18, 19-year-old kid that works in a gravel pit driving a front-end loader, making way less than Little Davis-Bacon wages, where if he's doing it on a big job, he can't work there. It, you know, if the contractor has a bigger job, he is forced to hire somebody, and maybe he can't even get an apprentice to manage this job. So the pipeline is important. We saw it in the airline industry decades ago, and we started allowing a little bit more flexibility on the way the pilots were trained and where they came from, air taxis being one of them. You're very familiar with that. So that was my intent with that amendment, and we have got to find a way in this legislature sometime in the future, in the near future, to increase the pipeline to the apprenticeship program. Because these are not necessarily jobs you can come right out of high school at 16 or 17 years old without starting out in a smaller sort of environment. So,
interesting.
That's why there's a problem. That's why nobody's sitting around drinking Mai Tais usually is because there's not enough apprentices.
And not enough people.
How did we go from a lawn chair umbrellas all the way to Mai Tais? But
not enough people like Mai Tais, I guess.
Representative Tilton, did I see your hand up?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I really missed the fun on the beginning of this this bill. Darn. I appreciate the attempt to try to increase the workforce here in Alaska, and I know that that is something that we need to do, and that, you know, that you yourself, the maker of this bill, has said that this is kind of an aspirational goal. I, though, come from a place where just government intervention in creating mandates into the private sector or even the public sector in what has to be done. I don't think that that always achieves the goal that we're looking for. And as Representative McCabe said, my understanding is that they're already trying to achieve existing ratios of trying to have apprentices come in, but there is a lack of that pipeline to fill those places. And I think that this could put some undue burden on small companies because they won't have those resources and it would limit their abilities to bid on contracts. And I mean, you know where I'm from, and you know that my thought is that government intervention with mandates doesn't always make things better. As a matter of fact, it normally goes in the opposite direction. So while I appreciate your goal of trying to fill the workforce and create more opportunity, I don't think I'm going to be voting yes on this legislation. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Then, as co-chair, I'd like to get the last word, if I may. What I hear is very much everyone sees the same problem. We have the same interests. We just don't always agree on how to get there. My perspective is I see this as a target, not a mandate. And I just know in my own professional life, whenever I've been evaluated, I always ask, what's the target? Because then I'm in charge of hitting the bullseye. And so I like this bill. And I do just want to say, whether it was beach chairs or Mai Tais, things kind of get lost. I right away, I thought about being in Hawaii. But, it is May Day. And I just one of the things that I've always appreciated is working people. And I just assume everyone works super hard. And when people are standing around, it's because they're waiting for something else to be done or they're being trained. They're not up yet. So I just is May Day, and I appreciate all the hardworking people, as I think we all do. I think we all do. And I think we all here work hard. So with that, would the clerk please call the roll on House Bill 186 as amended?
Representative Stoops.
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Tilton.
No.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Co-Chair Carrick.
Yes.
Co-Chair Eichheid.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 186, Work Order 34-LS0816/ A alpha is moved from committee as amended with accompanying fiscal notes. We're going to take a brief at ease to not only load the next presentation, but to sign the paperwork with House Bill 186 with individual recommendations. Next, we're here a short presentation from Department of Transportation and Public Facility staff on metropolitan planning area boundaries. I've said MPO so often, I still have a hard time saying it out loud. Mr. Mills and Ms. Little, Please approach the dais, state your names for the record, and begin your presentation. And I believe Ms. Little is online.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. For the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This presentation on MPO planning area boundaries, we appreciate the opportunity for the department to come and share some details. Certainly there have been some presentations about the MPOs in this committee, and we appreciate the opportunity to provide some context from the department. I'll say our chief engineer, Lauren Little, will do the majority of the presenting on this, which is good because I'm getting over something that I will endeavor not to share. And I would open up the start of the presentation by just noting that much of the conversation we'll have today on MPO boundaries does revolve around consultation and coordination between the department and the metropolitan planning organizations. And there have been conversations in the presentations to this committee that have outright said or intimated that the department is not coordinating with the MPOs on STIP submissions. And I would like to respectfully disagree or correct that by noting that the department may not be engaging in the way that MPOs do want to coordinate with, and certainly we want that exchange to understand what it is we can be doing to coordinate with them to meet their needs and in turn have them producing what the department needs to move forward. I say this because I was in a meeting with MVP in the summer where the last presentation noted we have not had any meetings. And so I would just note that I think it's a matter of perspective as to that we have met but maybe not had the meetings that they were looking for or follow-ups from those meetings that they had wanted. So just as a correction on the record. Again, I might let our chief engineer, Lauren Little, go ahead and jump in as we get into our first slide.
Hi, guys. Doing a quick mic check here. This is Lauren Little, chief engineer with Alaska DOT and PF. Am I coming through on your end?
Loud and clear, Ms. Little. Thank you. Please proceed.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Eichheit. So we can go to the next slide here. And I heard brief. There was a desire for brief, and so we will try to keep this very brief. The regulatory basis for the MPO updates, there's several CFRs that are tied back to the United States Code that dictate when boundaries must be updated. And we had a recent census, I believe it was 2020. And so when those are completed, there's a process that must be gone through to update these MPO boundaries, municipal planning organization boundaries, to align with the new urbanized areas. And so this is an exercise that's gone through on a regular basis. For this cycle, the deadline to complete the boundary updates and have them approved is December 31st, 2026. And all of those boundaries require governor approval of the new municipal planning organization boundaries. And there's several other requirements associated with these, but those are the key pieces, is they must include the new urbanized area and they require the governor's approval to become official. I'll pause there if there's questions on this slide. Otherwise, we can go to the next.
Andy Mills, for the record, I might jump in and ask, did all members receive the two letters, the AMATS and FAST letters that we... Okay. Just as there's a... I mentioned that because as we go through this document, there are going to be CFR references, the Code of Federal Registry, our federal regulation requirements that are associated. This is our attempt to show as we go through this presentation where that interpretation is coming from or where that requirement is coming from. And in the back of those letters was our folks are very proud at the legal team putting together this comprehensive index of authorities regarding NHS facilities. And so just as I making sure I put that both on the record and bring it to your attention as a reference point. Sorry.
Thank you.
Back to Ms. Little on slide three.
Yes, Lauren Little, Chief Engineer, for the record. So the consequences of missing the boundary approval deadline, I think this is probably where a lot of the conversation and concern has come in. There are potentially some very significant consequences for the communities in which these metropolitan planning organizations are located. It will essentially has the potential to impact their ability to program projects in the TIP and STIP. If we don't have an approved metropolitan planning area boundary that complies with the CFRs, which as mentioned before, must include that new urbanized area, then we don't have a way to approve the TIP or the STIP because we don't have an approved boundary. There's also air quality conformity components of this. We all became intimately familiar with for FAST. Areas in non-attainment can be challenging with those air quality conformity determinations. All TIPs and STIPs require an air quality conformity determination. And so depending on how all of those things shake out, the short version of this slide is projects may not be able to be programmed within those boundaries until a compliant boundary is approved by the governor. And I'll pause there again for questions.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, sorry, I'm just kind of catching up a little bit. I am a little bit concerned. Are you saying that, are we saying here in these slides, and maybe this is for you, Andy, that we're struggling to get these boundaries approved so that we can get the federal certification in the TMAs? Is that, and where did I miss it? Where is that coming from? I mean, why aren't they approved? Is it a executive branch? Is it a FAST thing or an AMATS or MVP?
Andy Mills, for the record, through the chair, Representative McCabe, thank you for that. We do later in here attempt to sort of give the specific areas where there are items of issue, the requirements that are needed for these boundary determinations to be reviewed and for potential approval. So we do provide later in this presentation sort of a summation of the items that are outstanding or at issue.
Follow up. Thanks. So I know that there was an issue in Fairbanks with the technical committee not meeting when it was supposed to or not meeting when it should. Is that where these boundaries come from?
Again, through the chair, Representative McCabe, I'll let Chief Lauren Little speak to that because, again, she's in the Fairbanks area, and okay. That's a good question for her.
Ms. Little, did you hear that question from Representative McCabe?
Lauren Little, for the record, yes, through the chair, Representative McCabe. There's not one specific thing that's leading to this discussion, and as Andy mentioned, we'll have a little bit more details. But I think the key piece here is the communication. We really need to talk through these issues with the MPOs to come to an understanding of how they got to the boundaries, their understanding of our concerns with the boundaries, and working towards a resolution well before December 31st of 2026. That's ultimately when these consequences would come into play. As of right now, there's some administrative inconveniences that stem from us not all seeing eye to eye on the details, but the TIPs can still move forward, projects can still be programmed with the current boundaries that the MPOs have in place. Does that answer your question a little better?
Follow up.
Thanks. And so, What I'm trying to get at is I know there has been resistance from the Fairbanks FAST Technical Committee, and I can say this, maybe you can't, with having a meeting for whatever reason. I've been told this from several different sources. And my question is specifically, is it the technical committee that's trying to set these boundaries, and is there reluctance to have a meeting creating this issue for the DOT right now?
Yes.
Lauren Little, for the record.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. There has been reluctance from both AMATS and FAST policy boards to discuss boundary and operating agreement updates with the department. We are hopeful that we can work through that, but as of right now, both FAST and AMATS policy boards have voted to table this discussion indefinitely.
Mr. Mills, did you want to address that? It looks like you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Andy Mills, for the record. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, one thing that helps me understand the dynamic on this and may get to answering part of your question is, again, the 3C process, which is the continuing, comprehensive, and cooperative, right? This is the process that establishes how we interact with the MPOs and is a federal requirement. I was surprised to learn that that requirement is essentially a list of requirements for the department and not for the MPO. It's not a two-way requirement. And so it was to better understand this dynamic, the operating agreements, which are part of the issue that there has been a reluctance to revisit and have those conversations, that is, in a sense, the other direction and having that two-way conversation, because you hear coordination, cooperation, and it sounds bidirectional, two-directional. I believe that there's separate processes that help govern how both entities would interact with each other. So the operating agreements are sort of linked in that larger conversation.
And just a follow-up on my part related to that, is when Ms. Little said the word reluctance, I was going to ask, what does that mean? But Mr. Mills, what I think I heard you say, so I'm giving you a chance, or Ms. Little, a chance to clarify. I thought I heard you say it was a one-way communication, and maybe reluctance means no response. I mean, can someone define what reluctance means? Because it's such a broad term.
Co-Chair Eichheit, thank you. Reluctance would mean setting the agenda. Reluctance in one circumstance means tabling indefinitely a conversation on. So reluctance has a couple different forms in this one. My reference was 3C being a process that articulates how DOT engages, and the operating agreement is how the MPO engages. So those two documents, in a way, provide the agreed upon engagement by the two different parties.
I think I understand that. And before we go to Representative McCabe, just, you know, we will have like some more dialogue from FAST and I think MVP and maybe AMATS when we get there. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So just to kind of put the nail in this coffin, if you will, the MPOs, all three of them, operate between an agreement with an agreement between the mayor and the governor. And I'm hearing the DOT saying that they have a way that they're supposed to communicate and cooperate and collaborate with the MPOs. And yet I'm hearing also that the MPO policy committees, and I had it wrong, I thought it was the technical committee, but it is the policy committees, have tabled the discussion that the DOT wants to have. And yet we hear all the time in this body that the DOT is the big problem with the STIP and with all the contractors and everything else. And yet the DOT appears to be wanting to communicate, and yet our MPOs I don't quite understand if they think they run the DOT or what, but they need to get back to the table. We need to quit standing in the corner and kicking our feet. We need to get back to the table and we need to discuss these. And I'm hearing the DOT saying that they're more than willing to do that. So where are the MPOs? That's my question.
Well, hopefully that's rhetorical. I was going to say at the end of this, but yes, thank you. Go ahead.
And Andy Mills, for the record. So I like to say there's an art in partnership, and we attempt to strike that balance. And in this case, again, the overlap on where we agree on our working together is far larger than the few items which we are not on the same page. And so this is attempting to reconcile the areas where we find differences and providing processes to work through those. Where there is no remedy, there often isn't a solution, and we need to find a solution to get past some of the impasses we have. So as far as an MPO boundary, it is certainly something we wish to continue to work towards getting, because It is a requirement. But the operating agreement updates are also inextricably linked to this conversation, and so that's why we raised them. But we'll get back to the slides to try and maintain the speed.
Momentum. Yes. Please proceed.
So again, I'll turn it back to slide four for Ms. Little.
Vaughn Little, for the record. So getting into the specifics on the boundaries, the AMAT's boundary proposal, as we mentioned earlier in the slides, urbanized areas are the focus of the federal regulations around MPOs. And when we started looking at the AMAT's boundary proposal, we saw some expansions into areas that could never become urbanized. For example, the Chugach State Park. It's protected from development. It's a state park. It does not logically follow that it would be urbanized in any future, as well as the Seward and Glen Highway corridors. There was expansion into those where, again, it's an interstate highway corridor right away. There's also very limited potential for future development and urbanization of those areas. And then we also identified, we weren't able to identify, I guess is how I should put this, what coordination occurred between AMATs and these other affected entities, such as the state parks, the Alaska Railroad, the boundary expansion. It was just very tough to understand the logic behind the expansions beyond the census boundary urbanized area, as well as what coordination had happened to ensure that everyone impacted by these expansions understood and cooperated in that process. So we continue to review those. We continue to work with the AMATs to understand these boundaries. But at this time, those are the key issues that we've found with the AMATs boundary. And then just moving on to the next slide here, while we stay in the AMATs lane, this is just sort of a detail showing that extension of the boundary beyond the urbanized line, which is where, you know, development has occurred or could potentially occur, encompassing more of the Seward Highway, despite the inability for any development to urbanize within that area. So I'll pause there if there's any questions on AMATs.
It looks like there's none. Please proceed.
Okay. So the FAST boundary, FAST planning followed a very robust process. They've got a very robust document summarizing their decision-making, the logic behind it, public outreach that was conducted. But there were still a few questions that came in. One, the legal sufficiency of the boundary. One of the things that happened with FAST that was alluded to earlier is the Chena flood control bridges, which when that project was initiated was outside of the current FAST planning boundary, but adjacent to it. And FAST asserted that the project was within their boundary. And because we didn't have a legal definition, we just sort of have a line on a GIS map. It created a lot of back and forth and conflict around whether or not the project was in or out. It was ultimately determined to be out, but it brought to the forefront for the department that we probably needed a little bit more than a crayon line on a map to make sure that we had a legally defensible as well as GIS compatible boundary in accordance with the CFRs and to be able to navigate these disputes in the future should they occur. There was also this donut hole on Farmer's Loop that really kind of jumped out at the review team as to why that area was excluded. And it did also come up in public comments as well as to why the area was excluded. There was an expansion onto the Richardson Highway. This was where the flood control bridges were. Despite the development areas, you know, it's a flood control project. There's no urbanized no potential for urbanization in that section, while there is urbanization on either side. And then there were some questions around the growth models that were used to ultimately select their final boundary. And then, as mentioned, on the next slide here, the Richardson Highway Chena Bridge project conflict, as well as that expansion, for the urbanized area, that line could easily bypass the flood control and still expand on either side, was some of the comments that came up in review of this boundary. So I'll pause there for fast boundary questions.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Ms. Little, the comments that came in through the chair, you're talking about the comments, public comments, right, that came in talking about the bridge and the floodplain and the expansion. Is that what I'm hearing?
For the record, Lauren Little, through the chair, Representative McCabe, the public comments were specific to there's a gap on Farmers Loop that was not included in the boundary expansion. So, I'm going off my memory of the image, but there's just sort of a gap in the middle in the Farmers Loop area that was omitted as not part of the urbanized potential for future urbanization and segment. It appeared to segment the boundary, and there were public comments questioning that logic too fast planning when they were going through their boundary adjustment process.
Follow up. Thank you. So the comments went directly to FAST, or did they go to the DOT and FAST has to pull them out of there? So I'm trying to figure out. I guess I'm trying to figure out where the public comment, the sort of the mechanics of how it all works.
For the record, Lauren Little, through the chair, Representative McCabe. I would have to get back to you on the details of those specific comments, when they were generated, and who they were directed at. My understanding is they were directed to fast planning through their public outreach efforts around the new boundary, but I would have to confirm that.
One more quick follow-up.
Yeah.
So not in it, Andy, you can answer this if you want. I see you nodding your head. So not comments through the E-STIP, but through the fast planning comment process.
For the record, Andy Mills, my belief as well, my understanding is that this is a boundary-specific solicitation, and that was for FAST. So,
okay.
But we can provide confirmation of that back. So,
yes,
and this is please. Pre-submission then to the department on the boundaries.
Yeah, and then I guess my own question is, my understanding is there was a segment of the area not included in the boundary. There were some public comment questions about why not. My understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the MPOs are usually will respond to comments on the record. They address them in some kind of summary statement. We got these comments. Here's our response. Is that correct?
So, again, for the record, Andy Mills, Co-Chair Eichheit, I'll let the MPOs okay. answer for that process. I wouldn't okay. want to speak for our partners.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Slide 8.
For the record, Lauren Little. So this is just a summary of the key correspondence that has occurred around the boundary expansion discussion, as well as we worked through the new STIP and the new expectations from the Federal Highway Administration around STIP-TIP coordination, where DOT projects should be shown. There were a lot of changes, and so all of that led to what we'll talk about next, which is the MPO operating agreements. And so this slide is really just showing that there has been this conversation started back in December of 2024, and it's been ongoing as we work towards resolution. So, MPO.
Just pause sorry. For a moment, please. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So a little confused on the chronology here. December 23rd, 2024, and then we go to February 16th, 2024. Is that first one supposed to be 2023 by any chance, December?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Ms. Little, it's or Mr. Mills, it's the very first bullet. Is that supposed to be 2023 rather than 2024?
And again, for the record, Andy Mills, through the chair, Representative McCabe, you're hired as our... yes, no, and indeed, yes, that is supposed to be 2023. Thank you.
Thanks. Helpful.
Yes. Thank you. Please proceed.
For the record, Lauren Little. So MPO operating agreement. This is what Mr. Mills was alluding to earlier. These agreements are essentially how DOT and the MPO policy boards are going to interact. They outline some basic regulatory frameworks. Every MPO has one of these. This is what these look like, varies across the country. But there is these agreements in place for how DOT and the MPOs are going to coordinate on projects, how they're going to manage the federal funding that comes through. They address a number of topics, but and they also speak to how, you know, MPOs, aside from AMATs, are made up of a variety of government entities. So, for example, FAST is the City of North Pole, Fairbanks North Star Borough, City of Fairbanks, as well as the DOT. And so all of those parties are essentially signing this agreement to understand how all of that coordination and collaboration is going to occur within the federal framework. And so moving on to the next slide, as we started going through these agreements as part of this boundary update and as well as addressing the new expectations from federal highways, historically, DOT was allowed to program projects that we were spending our funding on. For example, the University Avenue Rehabilitation and Widening Project in Fairbanks. We would show that project in the STIP. The TIP would also incorporate it, but the STIP sort of went first and showed the funding plan, the programming, the years. Federal Highways no longer wanted to see it in multiple places. And so everything was moved into the TIPS, which added a new layer of coordination that we had to work through. And that was some of the 3C document that Mr. Mills alluded to earlier. And that was sort of one of the big missing pieces in these agreements, was how we were going to coordinate on those projects, particularly on the National Highway System. MPOs get allocations of various funding sources. But the state of Alaska, the Department of Transportation, is the only entity that receives National Highway Performance Program funding. So the funding specific to the National Highway System. We are the only entity that can select and program those funds. There's no allocation for an MPO, for example. And so we identified that as a key deficiency, but of course it brought in looking at the agreements as a whole now as we tried to work through the how DOT and the MPOs were going to coordinate on all of these new expectations and ensuring that at the end of the day, our federal program gets out and we're repairing and improving the infrastructure that we need to be working on. And so this is just a table. These are, you know, the level of severity on these deficiencies varies, but some really key things that drove the department to say, hey, you know, we have to update these as part of this boundary, was the lack of how these projects were going to be coordinated, as well as just kind of going through and realizing that there was some outdated and missing regulatory references as well. The having processes for periodic reauthorizations, how conformity consultation occurred, just a lot of areas that we wanted to clean up and make sure that we were all on the same page and that there were no missteps in the future on communication coordination around DOT and MPO projects. So I'll pause there.
Yes, before we go to Representative McCabe, I just housekeeping thing. So in every column, AMATS, FAST, MVP, the various MPOs, is the clever little character there, which looks like a zero with a slash, is that like a check mark? Is that what that means? Or is that a bad thing? Because Yeah, there's no legend.
Yes, for the record, Lauren Little, to the chair. Correct. Those marks are indicating that those are areas that those agreements were determined to have deficiencies or need additional clarification.
And then a follow-up to that, it would look, according to this chart, the MVP from the Mat-Su is doing really good. Is that because they are from DOT's perspective, or is that because they are just forming and haven't gotten that far?
For the record, Lauren Little, to the chair. MVP's has the least deficiencies because it is the newest agreement. It was developed much more recently and modeled after successes learned through AMATS and FAST.
Gotcha. Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, just to clarify, periodic reauthorization, I think, that's missing in all of them. The MVP hasn't been signed yet because they're not completely done, which is what I understand. But it seems to me that both AMATS and FAST are missing, and that's the signature between the governor and the mayor that sort of codifies this agreement. Is that what I'm seeing?
Andy Mills for the record.
I'll go
this one. Thank you. Pause long enough just to see. Yes. So Andy Mills for the record, through the chair, Representative McCabe. That's correct. The missing periodic reauthorization piece, of course, is missing. And sorry, Co-Chair Eichheit, for the Ghostbuster symbol. We'll work on that. I found it attractive, but we'll work on something else for next time.
Representative McCabe, follow-up.
Follow-up. Thanks. So Mr. Mills... I think that I saw at one point the agreement between AMATS, and the last time it was signed was Mayor Knowles. Could that be possible? I mean, whose responsibility is it to update those reauthorizations, the DOT or the FAST that actually operates under the or the MPO rather that actually operates under the agreement?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that AMATS operating agreement at the end of the document is signed by Governor Tony Knowles, I believe 2002 is the date, and we mentioned that previously in the slide deck, but that is accurate, and certainly there's a question. In the earlier slides, we call it the base authorization, and I believe that's how AMATS would view that previous authorization and subsequent addendums. However, even periodic changes were not necessarily signed off by the commissioner. We had issues finding where we had signed off on those. We saw FHWA's approval, but not necessarily the department, the commissioners. And so that's why it's important for us to clearly identify that something has agreement and is reauthorized, given, again, the federal requirements and what's at stake in the requirements that have been at issue. So,
thanks.
Okay. Please proceed.
For the record, Lauren Little, I assume we're on slide 11 now.
Yes.
I won't spend a lot of time here. This is largely CFR references as to the basis for our review that generated our Ghostbuster symbols, as Mr. Mills so eloquently called them earlier. But essentially, you know, the point here is that you know, we're not attempting to be arbitrary or punitive. We've been through a lot of changing expectations with federal highways, a lot of scrutiny on things that didn't used to be scrutinized, and we're simply responding to that and trying to make sure that all of the things that we're doing, all of the agreements we have in place are meeting the necessary regulatory frameworks so that we're all on the right side of things and can move forward with simply efficiently delivering projects for the public. So the next slide is our timeline for the boundary change approval. As mentioned, December 31st of 2026 is the final date. There's a few steps associated with that. The first one is being able to talk through the department's concerns and questions on the boundary with the MPO policy boards and coming to resolution on a approvable MPO boundary expansion that meets the requirements of the CFRs. That's currently, as noted, in progress. which will trigger potentially revisions to the maps and GIS boundaries that the MPOs have provided to date, updating documentation, going through the technical committee endorsement and policy board approvals of the final boundaries, and then submitting to the governor's office for final approval, and then finally to FHWA and FTA. And with all of that is the working through these, how we're going to coordinate on these various topics that that have kind of cropped up on us, and we need to make sure we have a clear way to resolve conflicts between projects. So the next slide here on the intergovernmental operating agreement approvals. Right now, we submitted a very rough red line draft incorporating some of what our legal counsel advised was required for being within regulatory compliance. This is the area that we need to work together and get these agreements redlined, and how we're going to do these 3C processes, how we're going to coordinate on project conflicts. There's a lot of overlap between the MPO and the department. For example, we've had instances recently where MPOs have chosen to make decisions that affect a project's ability to move forward, whether it's the MPO choosing to stop a project because, for example, the Pearl Creek project in Fairbanks with the school closure, there's been discussions of removing that project. Well, when you spend federal highways dollars, you have to have a really good reason to close a project, or you have to pay that money back. There's no clear process in any of these agreements as to how that's handled when an MPO makes a decision to cancel a project that has federal money spent on it. Who is responsible for paying that money back? How will that process, how are those decisions made? How is that communicated for highways? These are just examples of some of the areas where coordination is not clear and needs to really be cleared up in these operating agreements, so that we don't end up in these seemingly unresolvable conflicts that start affecting the program and the ability to deliver projects to the public. So I'll pause there.
Yes.
Questions?
Representative McCabe?
Of course it's me. So I have two questions. I heard you say in what you were just talking about that an MPO could cancel a project that you had already encumbered money to. Do you have an example maybe of that happening? That would be amazing to me.
For the record, Lauren Little, through the chair, Representative McCabe. Right now, the Pearl Creek project is one. It has not actually moved to a closure, but the FAST Policy Board did vote to shift the funding to other projects. A final resolution of are they going to rescope the project? There is still a path to continuing the federal participation, but if the MPO chooses to simply close the project without construction, then per federal highways rules, that would typically require a payback of all the federal highways dollars spent on the project. The Safer Seward project is another example where the policy board recently voted to remove it from the MTP, Metropolitan Transportation Plan, which informs, that's sort of the long-range plan that informs the programming within the TIPS. That project has a federal highways ATP on it. Quite a bit of funding has been spent on it. And so that does have the potential, if that project were completely within the MPO, their decision to remove it would prevent it from receiving any additional federal funding, which would effectively require us to close it or find other funding. So again, it would be a state payback or state funding to continue the project, both of which are pretty hard to stomach when the decision is being made, somewhat outside of our control.
Andy Mills, Mr. Mills, and then we'll go to Representative McCabe for his follow-up.
Just to underscore that particular point, especially for anyone who may be watching this who may not be as familiar, the Safer Seward Highway is a perfect example of how the MPO boundary conversation has this nexus with impacts that are very difficult because that particular stretch of highway, I mean, I've heard from constituents that say they don't feel safe driving down to Girdwood from rockfall, from fast-moving traffic with no separation, and no one in Alaska should be on a significant artery feeling that way. To have a project stalled or stopped because of an MPO boundary disagreement, that's untenable for fixing some of Alaska's largest arteries that have the greatest safety concerns. That's a safety corridor. We're solving the Kinnick-Goose Bay Road. We're working on the Sterling Safety Corridor. There's a lot of safety corridors we're addressing. This is a significant, this is probably the most important one for us to get underway so that we're solving this significant safety issue. So I just would underscore that this is a perfect example of a very critical corridor that we cannot wait to solve the safety issues.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So suddenly I'm very concerned. So you say that we got federal highway money for a project, Crow Creek, is that the one?
Yep.
Crow Creek, we got federal highway money. It likely had a state match, which came from us, and we gave it to the DOT to do this project because the MPO, FAST in this case, said it needed to be done. And now FAST is going to say no, and then we're on the hook for that, for paying back the federal funds? I'm beyond incredulous that a local planning organization could undermine the DOT and cancel a project and encumber the state of Alaska to pay back federal funds. That's just not right, and it needs to be fixed, like most Ricky Tick.
Mr. Mills, do you have Ms. Little, do you have a response to Mr. McCabe's comment?
I do. For the record, Lauren Little through the chair, Representative McCabe. But just one point of clarification. While the state could be on the hook for the federal payback, the federal dollars that were spent, I believe that project was a local match that the local, probably most likely in this case, the Fairbanks North Shore Borough would have provided the match component of that. But that would still leave potentially the state of Alaska for the federal payback, which would have been the, you know, roughly 90% share of the project cost spent to date.
And just to clarify, there has not been any payback because of a canceled project. Is that correct? Has money been returned? Have we been on the hook for something and money been transferred? Because I hear, like, this could happen. Well, I'm asking, has it happened?
For the record, Lauren Little to the chair. To my knowledge, we have not run into this to date, but we have several instances right now that if we don't work out the procedures and how this gets coordinated to ensure we don't end up, that is a potential outcome for some of the projects that the MPOs have changed their minds on.
And Mr. Mills, you want to add to that, and then we'll go to Mr. Representative McCabe. Yeah.
For the record, Andy Mills, I just wanted to note, some folks may hear the term non-PAR, that's non-participation, and what that'll mean is if we cannot certify or get the federal partner to sign off, then the state is on the hook for that. So there's, unfortunately, there are numerous areas where the state must conform to federal requirements and get federal partner sign off on certain key aspects of a project, otherwise it is correct that the state will be on the hook for any federal dollars expended that do not qualify for federal reimbursement.
And when you say federal partners, you're talking about the MPOs in question.
Through the chair, when I say federal partners, I mean FHWA, Fed Highways, Federal Transit, Federal Aviation. So I'm meaning our federal partners, funding partners.
Understood. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So that leads to my final question, and then I'll shut up. Is this indefinitely postponed thing in the FAST status block, is that what we're talking about, where it says MPO Policy Board reauthorization resolution? Is that the kind of thing where we're talking about because they won't come to the table because they've tabled the reauthorization? Now we don't know if who's going to pay if they cancel a project. Is that sort of what I'm seeing here?
For the record, Lauren Little, through the chair, Representative McCabe, the reauthorization resolution, that would be the agreement to work through the operating agreement updates and ultimately update the operating agreement. When the department brought the need for operating agreement updates to the FAST Policy Board, they ultimately voted to indefinitely postpone any discussion on the topic, which essentially rendered it to where the department and the MPO can't find resolution if conversation won't occur.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please proceed. That's it.
Mr. Chairman, that unless there are any other questions, Andy Mills for the record, we're done with our presentation. Try to keep it fast.
Just a question for me, a final question, if I may, because we do want to move to our next group. You know, to just be frank, I feel like I was on recess duty and I turned my back and some of the kids got into an argument. And so here we are trying to figure out what happened. And, you know, I'm a former teacher, so I've heard and seen it all. Is there anything that DOT, and I know this is a sensitive question, but it should be asked, is there anything DOT could have done better in this process in hindsight? Maybe one thing as a reflective response before we go to our MPOs.
Andy Mills for the record. So Chair Eichheit, it's a good question. And so continually, I'll go back to the art and partnership. We are trying to, there are many factors that go into a relationship. There's everything from perceived issues with a particular ore haul, or there are other issues like air conformity. There's a lot of elements that play into the interplay that we have with our MPO partners. But again, at the end of the day, we're all, I believe, working to get our infrastructure program advancing because these areas want to see improvements. We're just at odds at the interpretation, which is why we need to put something in writing and we need to both come to the table. And where there are differences, I agree that from a DOT perspective, I think that you get a bit of a bunker mentality when you're under fire by folks that you feel is unnecessary or not accurate. If someone says you're never talking to me, but you know that you have talked to them, that creates a hard dynamic to have a conversation under. And I believe that they're interpreting it as I did not get the engagement I was looking for. I don't think a marriage counselor is necessary, but I do think that increased communication does help. We're finding that we're facing other challenges on the federal front, but our Fed Highway partners, we have a much better relationship than we had 1 year ago this time, and it's heartening to see us sort of working to restore lines of communication that were frazzled or had issues. And I believe our MPO partners can be in that same dynamic where we're working with them together rather than focusing on where we're at odds.
I really appreciate that. And, I think of that playground example. In so many things in life, it's not what happened yesterday or 10 minutes ago. It's how are we going to do better? Or as I say in my office, how are we going to make better mistakes tomorrow? So, Representative McCade, last word, but just one word because we want to go to our
No, folks. I think the problem here is the blurred lines of responsibility. So who works for who? Does the MPO, do they drive everything? Do they actually run the DOT in the state of Alaska? Or do they work for or with the DOT? I mean, who works for who? And unfortunately, when you're dealing with big projects and all this money, it becomes very blurred, and I think that's the crux of the issue here and maybe some personalities as well. Mine might be part of that.
Thank you. And finally, Co-Chair Carey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. So last time it was over a month ago, so it's kind of a refresher today that we had this conversation, Mr. Mills. I made some notes on a organizational chart to try to understand the relationships between these entities. And I think to the previous speaker's comment, it's not a question of who works for who. Nobody works for anybody directly. So would you say that's an incorrect statement to start with?
Through the chair, Kosher, Co-Chair Carrick, what I actually, in all my onboardings of the department, and I would apply this to this situation, we all work for the people. I try to remind folks about the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, I think it is, and I try to tell people we have customers, even though they have no other place to shop. And so in my case, I try to actually reaffirm that when we're talking about it. So I do believe we all do actually work for someone, and recognizing that can help us understand what the real mission is.
Follow up. I might have a couple thoughts here, actually, Mr. Co-Chair. And I'm not trying to necessarily make a point. I'm just trying to understand. But this is all quite complicated, and none of us here are transportation planners in our day jobs. And so I think Co-Chair Aishai was.
Planner, not, but I worked with transportation planners. It's quite complex.
Mr. Co-Chair. I'm not a transportation planner in my day job, so I tried to explain this to myself like I was five, and I just want to make a statement and have you correct me if I'm wrong. So what I wrote, and I agree, that nobody works for anybody in this relationship between Federal Highways, DOT, and the MPO organizations. But what I wrote down is that MPOs must consult with Federal Highways, and they make allocation decisions and receive their funds through DOT. DOT makes allocation decisions and receives funds through Federal Highways, but they must consult with MPOs. And Federal Highways must consult with MPOs, and they provide or disapprove funds for DOT. Is anything I said like completely and wholly an inaccurate statement? And could you clarify it if so?
So, Co-Chair Carrick, what I might do is, if you want, I can take that in writing and try and give you a written response. I wouldn't want to do it off the cuff, mostly because the Theraflu that I'm on, it leaves me a little cloudy, and I wouldn't want to put something on the record with that. Generally speaking, I do think there's commensurate sort of responsibilities, but also roles and responsibilities. So every one of the folks that you're listing, they do have a set of responsibilities in their roles. And I don't think everyone in those roles is understanding sort of the interplay of the responsibilities they have. That's what we're trying to put something in writing and agree upon it. Where there is squish, there will be problems. And I think right now we have, it's not that it's necessarily not fully documented, but it's certainly, if it's not in writing and you can't agree upon it, then there will be disputes that otherwise would be avoidable. So I really do think that's codifying those and agreeing upon those, and that hence the operating agreements and the updated 3C policy. These are vital to us successfully advancing. And I believe Ms. Little mentioned in a preparatory conversation to this that we did have our MPOs produce some updated STIPs as part of our recent STIP amendment. It lined up very well. So as a current example, there's work that I think is yielding positive results that show better coordination. So I think we can come back to you in a year and hopefully show you that things have improved and that hopefully we have reached agreement.
Final follow-up,
but we really have to move on after this because we have less than 30 minutes for our MPOs.
For sure. Thank you so much, Co-Chair Aishai. I just thank you for that response, Mr. Mills. I think there's probably a tendency in this conversation to look at a top-down look at this, like Federal Highways provide funds, they approve or disapprove to DOT, and then DOT is above the MPOs, and they approve or disapprove to the MPOs. I hope what's been really clear in this conversation is that there was a dispute, but it's not as easy as just blaming the next organization down. In other words, there's room for improvement for all actors here, and I just think that that really needs to be said. And my good friend from Big Lake likes to say all the time he can't think of a worse group of people to set policy and regulation than the Alaska State Legislature. I could probably say the same back at him for mediating a dispute of this complexity, but I appreciate you helping us try to understand.
I'd like to thank Mr. Mills and Ms. Little and the committee with just a fantastic discussion very stimulating. I hope the public finds it as stimulating. I hope Mr. Mills and Ms. Little can stick around. We're going to move to our MPOs, but I do want to end at 3. So thank you. Next, I'd like to invite Assemblyperson Scott Crass of Fairbanks to provide testimony on the FAST Policy Board's experience with the Metropolitan Planning Area Boundary Process. And so I'm going to welcome Mr. Crass. I believe he's online. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just stand by, Mr. Crass. I just want to ask assembly or committee members to hold their questions till he's done with his testimony. And then I also want to make sure everyone's aware for questions. We are also joined by some other MPOs. We are joined by Kim Solian from MVP for Transportation in the Mat-Su, Jackson Fox from Fast Planning in the Fairbanks area, and I think Aaron Younginen. Is Aaron on? Yeah. Say the name again.
Younginen.
Mr. Younginen, as a person who's had my name, last name mispronounced, I feel your pain. Mr. Crass, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony, and then we'll take questions when you're done.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Eichheit and Carrick, committee members. My name is Scott Crass. I'm the appointed representative of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly on the FAST Planning Policy Board, and I have been for about 2 years now. Over the past year and a half, DOT has been asserting that MPOs have no authority for planning, approving, or rejecting projects on the national highway system in response to Federal Highway Administration denying funding for new NHS projects proposed by the state DOT in the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, STIP. These new NHS projects, the Steese Highway Milepost 5 and replacement of the Richardson Highway Milepost 346 Bridge, locally we refer to that as the Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges, they should have been, but they were not coordinated with the MPO, and so they were not included in our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, the MTP, or our Transportation Improvement Program, the TIP. A lot of acronyms I found in FAST Planning and with MPOs. Federal regulations are clear that all projects proposed for federal highway and transit funding for the transportation network, including the NHS, must be included in the MPO's MTP and TIP to be eligible for funding. The Anchorage MPO is in the same boat in response to Federal Highways denying funding for 4 new projects proposed by DOT and the STIP that should have been coordinated with their MPO. This dispute has escalated to DOT not approving our new MPA boundary, which was adopted unanimously, that's including the DOT representative, and submitted in December 2023. There seem to be 2 driving motivations behind this non-approval. First is the Federal Highways approval for funding of the Richardson Highway Bridge replacements, the Conn and Nellie Miller Bridges, because the project is outside the old MPA boundary but within the new MPA boundary. And number 2 is attempting to link the approval of the new MPA boundary to updating the operating agreement to leverage DOT's demand to accept their proposed edits, which take decision-making authority away from the policy board for local transportation projects on the national highway system. The DOT Commissioner's Office succeeded in their efforts with regards to the Conn and Nellie Miller Bridge, the Richardson Milepost 346 Bridge replacement, by traveling to DC and meeting with the Federal Highways Executive Director, who overruled the Federal Highways Alaska Division Office, which had required DOT to coordinate the project with FAST Planning. And separately, our borough assembly also supported the project contingent on the addition of a separated bike path. With regard to the second motivation, the attempt by DOT to make the new MPA boundary approval contingent upon the acceptance of DOT's proposed edits to the operating agreement, there are no provisions in federal code linking them. Federal highway staff have internally reviewed the regulations along with FAST staff and our executive director, who's also on the line, and they all concurred that they are separate documents with separate approvals. So the last time the MPA boundary was changed was in 2021, and it was approved by Governor Dunleavy without an update to our operating agreement. The DOT has said our policy board meetings that they're withholding our new boundary from the governor's office for consideration of approval. So the root of the issue is this. Federal regulations are clear that all projects proposed for federal highway and transit funding for the transportation network, including the NHS, must be included in the MPO's MTP and TIP to be eligible for funding. And the MPO's policy board has the authority to accept or reject any projects, including those on the highway system. There's no undercutting of DOT's responsibilities here to participate in planning projects on the highway system, but it comes down to the decision-making authority of the MPO's policy, of the MPO's policy board, of which DOT is a voting member. So being provided a list of projects by DOT for incorporation into the TIP does not and should not guarantee their incorporation into the TIP. This is a decision by the policy board on a project-by-project basis. And that authority has been exercised in the past by both Fast Planning and AMATS. And I'll keep it brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crass. Questions from the committee for Mr. Crass or any of the other experts online? Then I'll start some things out. So, Mr. Crass, it just listening to you, it sounds like there's a dispute over the interpretation of federal regulations and authorities. So, since I'm not a lawyer, have lawyers gotten involved in this at all? Because it seems like it's when you have two sides that have a fundamental dispute over what the law requires, you go to court. And, of course, no one likes that, but the judicial branch does make decisions like that. So, can you answer that and relate it to it? Is can you suggest a path forward? Because I think ultimately that's what we're all interested in.
You know, our policy board, Mr. Chair, our policy board considered the adoption, considered obtaining outside legal counsel, but in the absence of any legal proceedings, the feeling was that, you know, our opinion was as good as anybody's.
Okay, thank you. And then one question I had was DOT had presented from a December 10th, 2024 meeting, I believe the FAST MPO had tabled a decision indefinitely. Is that correct? And is there a reason to table something indefinitely from the FAST perspective versus table to a time certain?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the policy board, I think, they all felt that this would erode local control. And so we tabled this issue indefinitely because there wasn't a path forward with the proposed edits. They removed local control, and that wasn't tenable. The policy board makeup is the mayor of North Pole, the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and then you have the state DOT, the state DEC as a representative, myself from the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. And so there's a lot of, I almost forgot our chair, Jerry Clearworth is with Fairbanks City Council. So there's a lot of municipal leadership there that has a strong desire to retain local control over the authority to plan these projects.
Thank you. And then I guess my final follow-up to that is, again, this was kind of a global question, but I want to get it out while we have time. Is there anything that you think FAST or the MPOs could do better moving forward that will move us along, or do you expect this to stay somewhat a conflictual situation? So I'm looking for any solutions you can propose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's difficult because the changes that are proposed to our operating agreements are, I feel, a non-starter for many members of the policy board. And additionally, just there's a reluctance to open up those operating agreements, as you can imagine, with the three municipalities and then the state of Alaska's administration. developing those was an intensive and costly process. I wasn't involved in the crafting of the last one. I would look to Jackson Fox for any who's on the line for what that past experience was like. But there isn't a desire to undertake that effort when the end goal seems to be to reduce local control.
And before we go to Representative McCabe, Mr. Fox, did you want to comment about that process of renegotiating these operating agreements that Mr. Crass referenced?
Yes, absolutely. So this is Jackson Fox with Fast Planning, for the record, to the chair. The last time that we updated our operating agreement was in 2018. It was eventually signed in April of 2019, but it did take over a year to negotiate that agreement. And what that involved was four attorneys sitting at the table. This included, you know, in addition to the state attorney, the three local municipal attorneys up here in Fairbanks and North Pole. And as you can imagine, if you've got four attorneys around the table, there's going to be quite a few disagreements. And not everybody got their way. There was definitely some hurt feelings at the end of that process. But you know, at the end of this process of trying to negotiate this agreement, it still has to go through our two city councils as well as our Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. And then that opens you up to a whole lot of other opinions at that time. And if one party, any one of those parties, says no to the language in the agreement, then you're at a stalemate as far as moving forward any edits. So it is a intensive process. And in this particular case, as Mr. Kraft alluded to, not a high chance of success in getting these new edits that are provided by DOT through both councils and the assembly, or even getting them through a legal review with our municipal attorneys.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Representative McCabe?
Thanks. Through the chair, well, maybe we should just blow the whole thing up and do away with the municipal planning organization and go back to the way the Valley's been doing it for the last 20 years, was just have the DOT administer all of the state roads. If we can't get an operating agreement to go through three assemblies and a fast planning and the DOT with a bunch of lawyers, then maybe we just ought to stop the municipal planning organizations instead of fighting like this. So I do have a couple of comments, probably for Mr. Fox. What kind of contact do you normally have with the Federal Highway Administrations? Do you have emails and phone calls? I heard Representative Carrick say that, you guys were kind of co-equal with the DOT and that you should be dealing directly with the Federal Highway Administration. So I'm wondering, do you talk to them daily or weekly or monthly, and do you have emails back and forth?
Yes, for the record, again, this is Jackson Fox with Fast Planning, through the chair to Mr. McCabe. Yes, we do. All three of our MPOs have regular communications with the Federal Highway Administration staff, as well as Federal Transit Administration staff. All of the required planning documents that we produce must be approved by those agencies. So a lot of our discussions are surrounding, questions and, content of our plans for consistency and compliance with the regulations. We also have a quarterly meeting each year where all three MPOs and state DOT and our federal partners get together for an all-day meeting to discuss various issues. But to answer your question a little bit more directly there, yes, there are emails back and forth. There are phone calls back and forth. It could be a couple times a month. I wouldn't say that it's every week.
Yeah, and let me just follow up on your first comment, and then I'll go back to you, Representative McCabe. I just wanted to know, if we got rid of the three MPOs, would the urbanized areas of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Nemadsu, would they be able to get federal highway money without the MPOs under current law?
Thank you for the question. Again, for the record, Jackson Fox with Fast Planning to the chair. If the MPOs disappeared from the state of Alaska, no federal highway or transit funding could be spent in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or the Matsu areas until a new organization replaced the ones that were removed.
Okay, thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Not entirely true. The Matsu Valley has been doing federal highway funding for the last two decades without an MPO. And we have, in fact, we waited till we were over 100,000 people before we got an MPO. That's the trigger. It's actually 50, but depending on the area. So we have managed to somehow get federal highway funding for the Parks Highway and for a bunch of state highways through there. I was a little bit being facetious. But in response, Mr. Fox, to your comment on the emails, 3 months ago I put in a records request for all the emails between your office and anybody in Fast Planning and the Federal Highway Administration. What I received back was the minutes from four of the meetings that you talked about and no emails. So I will be looking forward to seeing those. In fact, we actually paid money for it because of the intensity of this search, apparently. So I'll be looking forward to seeing all those emails between you and the Federal Highway Administration. Another question that I have, all this seemed to start with the Moncho black gold trucking issues. So can you confirm that that has been sort of the trigger for this sort of issue between the DOT and the Fast Planning?
Yeah, so again, this is Jackson Fox with Fast Planning, for the record, through the chair to Representative McCabe. Yes, you know, a year and a half ago when it was announced that there would be an overhaul through our community, through our urbanized area, it created a lot of public controversy in which, you know, we have followed and experienced through our technical committee and policy board with a lot of public comment. And yes, there were bridge replacement projects that were being planned and moved into design and going ahead to construction to support that overhaul that were not coordinated with our MPO to be included in our long and short range plan. So that is kind of the start of the divergence here that we've had with DOT up in Fairbanks.
Follow up.
I'd like to get a question to Ms. Solian first, and then I'll come back to you, Representative McCabe, for one more. Now I want to go to my co-chair. Ms. Solian, Representative McCabe said the MATSU had got along without an MPO for a long time. But isn't it true that the MPO, that the MATSU did not have the requirement to develop an MPO until this most recent census? So the MATSU didn't have an MPO because they didn't require one till just recently with the new census. Is that correct?
Through Co-Chair Aishai, yes, that is correct. The MATSU Borough did not, or the region did not have an MPO because we hadn't reached that urban area population density threshold within the greater core area. And when the census was certified in 2022 of December, that's when we got our designation, and that's when the clock started to form an MPO within 1 year of designation.
Thank you. I believe I worked with you a little bit on that, so thank you. Representative McCabe, one more, and then we'll go to Representative.
So, yeah, not really required. It's something that we request, that you don't necessarily have to have an MPO. You can request an MPO and put together one.
You won't receive the federal money.
You will still receive some federal money, just not all of the federal money that's available to the MPOs in the state of Alaska. Yes, that's true.
Thank you.
So, you kind of sidelined me by going.
I'm tricky.
Yeah, I had another question for Mr. Fox. If I think of it, I'll come back.
Okay, I'll come back to you. Question. I just want to give Co-Chair Carrick a chance.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, I don't know how MATSU is, but I can tell you Fairbanks could really use federal highway dollars. And we have to have an MPO per our population requirements. And not only do we have to, I would say we functionally have to in order to receive those federal dollars. So what I was referencing earlier is the relationship between federal highways and MPOs is sort of, I guess I want to ask Mr. Fox or Ms. Solian to respond. The relationship between MPOs and federal highways is inherent in the organization of a metropolitan planning organization. In other words, there is meant to be consultation there from the development and going forward. Can you correct me if I'm wrong there?
This is, for the record, this is Jackson Fox with Fast Planning to the co-chair, Carrick. Yes, that consultation is required, and we have a very positive relationship, and communicate frequently as needed.
Okay, quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So as a follow-up through the co-chair, I want to go back to this organizational chart that I wrote out when Ms. Solian was presenting at our last hearing on this issue. And again, it was over a month ago, and I know that the relationships are more complicated than all of this, but can you just, for the MPO's part, just tell me if I'm missing any gaps in making the statement that MPOs make allocation decisions and receive funds through DOT, and they consult with federal highways. And please correct me if I'm wrong there. And additionally, tell me what's not going correct in those relationships from the perspective of each of our MVP and FAST planning.
Again, for the record, this is Jackson Fox with FAST Planning, through the co-chair to co-chair Carrick. The way you described that relationship between federal highways, MPOs, and state DOTs, I believe that to be accurate. So, the state of Alaska has apportioned funding. A certain amount of that funding is set aside for MPOs. But yes, all the funding goes through DOT, and then we have to consult back with our federal partners for plan approvals on spending those funds. The only one thing I'll add in that relationship there is that DOT, as Ms. Little stated in her presentation, is the fiscal steward of those funds. So the state DOT does carry risk in some of these non-participating fund issues. And then I believe the end of your question there is what is not working well, in my opinion. And I do believe it's kind of that top-down approach of funding coming from federal highways down to the state DOT and then to us, and that the state DOT asserts that with the funding that is allocated for our area, that they have decision-making authority over some of those funds.
Thank you. To me, that also seems to be the problem here, is from the outside, not understanding, all the nuances of these complex relationships with transportation planning, it seems really easy to say, well, there's a top-down approach, and so Federal Highways has all the money, DOT is but the transporter of those funds to the local agencies, and the local agencies are just getting in the way. I think that's an oversimplification of what's happening here, and I just appreciate more context, because I think we're all just at this point trying to learn how it works, what happened, and what we can do better. And I guess I want to repeat Co-Chair Eichheit's question one more time to both the MPO directors. What is it that the MPOs could potentially be doing better or more of in the future to help mitigate some of these challenges?
Again, for the record, this is Jackson Fox with FAST Planning, through the chair to co-chair Carrick there. Lauren Little and Andy Mills had referenced a 3C document, which outlines procedures and protocols for how we interact with each other. This has been, I think, a work in progress for possibly up to a year. But what this document does is it helps set expectations for all parties at the table. And I think that we've not finished that document yet and not come to agreement on all the terms, but I think that we all need to continue working on that document and try to reach some type of consensus and something that's very prescriptive, such that if new staff come in, a process can be easily understood and easily followed. And so I believe all three MPOs, we are committed to continuing that process to sort out expectations on both sides with the hope that both sides are happy with the process that we outlined together.
Just as a very final follow-up, Co-Chair Eichheit, when do we expect that document to be finalized, if we know yet?
This is Jack, again, for the record, this is Jackson Fox of FAST Planning, through the chair to Co-Chair Carrick. This is something that we have been working on kind of month to month, but it really pops up for kind of more immediate discussion at our quarterly meetings, where we have the state DOT, all three MPOs, and our federal partners at the table. Our next meeting will be June 3rd down in Anchorage for an all-day meeting, and this will be on the agenda for continued discussion. And then we work on this document between those quarterly meetings. So I would hope that in 2025 that we can get to some type of consensus and wrap this document up this year. That's my hope.
Thank you. And we're going to represent McCabe. This will be our last chance for a question because we're almost done with time. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Mr. Fox, you made a statement earlier that the DOT did not come to you before they allowed Moncho trucking on your MPO highways. Do you think that it's within the purview of the FAST planning to regulate commercial traffic on a federal highway?
For the record, this is Jackson Fox with FAST planning, and through the chair to Representative McCabe. No, I don't think it's within our authority to regulate, say, a freight haul like this through our community. But it is something that, as an MPO, in doing transportation planning, that we would like to have been involved from the start to help plan for the success of that so that it would reduce the impacts to the traveling public and through our community.
Representative Tilton, did you have any final thoughts? Representative Carrick?
I'm good.
Okay, I'd just like to give a final thought. First of all, it's a fantastic discussion. Again, I hope that we can continue this conversation, except I hope in a year we aren't sitting here having the same conversation. My perspective, having been a former planner, working with transportation planners and working on the MATSU MPO process, is the whole idea of the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, was to give some local input into transportation planning, because in the past, some of our federal partners have just paved anywhere they want, and that doesn't always work out in the end. Sometimes we have to fix things. So I do appreciate the state DOT. I do appreciate our MPOs and our federal partners, and I appreciate this robust conversation. So thank you for that. And thank you to our presenters. I won't say you all by name because I can't pronounce some of them, and there's a lot of you. But thank you for being here. This concludes today's House Transportation Committee meeting. Thank you to everyone for taking the time. Our next House Transportation Committee meeting will be Tuesday, May 6th at 1 o'clock p.m. in Room 124, Capitol Building. The presentations will be on House Bill 167, Harold Esmalka. Say again?
Esmalka
Airport at Ruby. And we'll hear public testimony on House Bill 136, Railroad Utility Corridors. Seeing no other comments and having the assignment on pronouncing names better, this meeting of the House Transportation Committee is adjourned at 3 o'clock p.m.